This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Anna Lindner, your host, and today we are talking to one of the editors of a volume called Cuba and Puerto Rico, Transdisciplinary Approaches to History, Literature, and Culture. Today we have Dr. Jorge Duany online with us to talk about his work and the book and how it came about. Jorge, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. So Dr. Duany is the director of the Cuban Research Institute and professor of anthropology in the Department of Global and Sociocultural Studies at Florida International University. So I was wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit more about either your personal investment in this project and or your own work academically on this topic and how this book came about.
Yeah, thank you for the question. And of course, those two are very closely intertwined, as you know. So my personal and my academic and professional activities are focused on these two countries, Cuba and Puerto Rico, for both autobiographical and non-biographical reasons. So I was born in Cuba and raised in Panama and Puerto Rico. And then after completing my studies, I returned to Puerto Rico, spent there a few more decades until I came to Florida in 2012, where I am now based, as you mentioned, as a professor of anthropology, but also most of my time I spend directing the Cuban Research Institute. So this is very close to my heart, and I have written an essay that talks about my own experiences, but also connecting it to my academic pursuits. And maybe that's the other part of the question that I want to address. I did my PhD dissertation on the Cuban community in San Juan, to which my own family belongs. We arrived in 1966 and were part of this growing community at the time. And now it's not growing anymore. It's actually dwindling since the 1970s. But I was part of a social club called Casa Cuba that I basically had all my friends in, and my siblings and I spent most weekends there, etc. And so that led me then to try to understand myself and my own community in a more academic way. So that's why I decided to focus on studying the Cuban-American, the Cuban-Puerto Rican community, actually. And that's a slip of the tongue because now I'm more concern or more directly related to the Cuban-American community here in Miami. But I do feel something of a Cuba Rican, which is the title of that piece, the very last essay in the edited volume, that somehow I think brings together this the term Cuba Rican, the ambivalent hybrid cultural identity that I have felt for a long, long time. and that I finally, after many years, feel comfortable with. So maybe that's an introduction to other topics that you may want to talk about more in more detail.
Yeah, and you're particularly known for your work on migration, movement between regions, so specifically in the Caribbean with the United States, North America. I guess, how has your scholarship on that developed? How do you see it being so important to look at how people are moving between places, both physically, but also, you know, metaphorically, cognitively, socially, moving between multiple countries in across Latin America and the Caribbean and also the United States and maybe back again?
Yeah, so I think my work, now looking back at it since the mid-1980s when I got my PhD to the present, has progressed in several stages. So I mentioned the first stage was my dissertation on Cubans in Puerto Rico, which is sort of autobiographical and autoethnographic. And then my next project was also based in Puerto Rico, but looking at Dominican migration to Puerto Rico, which at the time had not been studied well and continues to affect Puerto Rican society. And I'm also interested in that group of people. And finally, I turned to Puerto Rican migration, both to the U.S. and return migration, or what I then called some time ago, a circular migration. So one of my books in 2002 was entitled The Puerto Rican Nation on the Move, which is actually more, I think, interesting in Spanish. It's La Nación en Vaivén, Vaivén. This term, this sort of folk term referring to the coming and going of Puerto Ricans in both directions. And that flow actually between the U.S. and Puerto Rico has continued unabated in the last decades. So somehow I got to study the three main countries of the Hispanic Caribbean, Cuba, Dominican Republic, and Puerto Rico. Although, as I mentioned in my first answer, now I'm more concentrated on the Cuban exodus, and particularly to Miami and to the United States. But I continue to be interested in the Spanish Caribbean, the Spanish-speaking Caribbean. And as you hinted in your question as well, also in what the Hispanic Caribbean case tells about transnational movements, about diasporas, about identities. And actually, I also wrote another book sort of summarizing what I knew then in 2011. It's called Blurred Borders, Transnational Migration Between the Hispanic Caribbean and the United States.
Yeah. And I guess since you've been in the field for a while, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about, you're specifically in anthropology, so you'll probably be looking at it from that lens, but how the field has changed, how Caribbean studies has changed, identitarian kind of understandings, particularly in that transnational or trans, you know, migratory lens, how things have changed over the last several decades and where we're going maybe too.
Yeah, one of my main fields reading, I remember that I had to put together a reading list like most PhD students have to do to survive, was Caribbean studies. And this was early 1980s. At that time, the field of Caribbean migration studies was not well developed. It was mostly, you know, studies of particular countries in the Caribbean, Haiti, Jamaica, some studies of Puerto Rico, but migration was not then a major concern. I think it is now. So that's one of the main changes. And perhaps that has to do with the sheer number of Caribbean citizens who are not living in the territories of origin. And if you actually compare the numbers, the Caribbean is probably the largest migrant sending region in the world. And I don't have the exact numbers right now with me, but it's pretty telling that, for example, in the Puerto Rican case, there are many more Puerto Ricans living outside Puerto Rico than in the mainland, in the U.S. mainland. It's about two-thirds of all people of Puerto Rican origin are now based in the continental, in the 50 United States. For Dominican Republic and Cuba, it's about 17%. And for some of the other non-Hispanic countries, it's quite substantial. For example, Jamaica or Barbados, which was one of the first migrant-sending countries in the region to be really depopulated since the 19th century because of migration. So it's hard for me to characterize the field as a whole, but I would say for me, as I began to look for theoretical approaches to the study of Caribbean migration in the 1990s, actually, I found myself in dialogue with the so-called transnational perspective, which was inaugurated by a group of anthropologists, Nina Glick-Schiller among them, and that really promoted this new field of studies. And, you know, 30 years later, it's still quite important. So I see my own work, particularly dealing with the post-1990s flow of Dominicans, Puerto Ricans, and Cubans as contributing to the field of transnationalism and the close related field of diaspora studies. And in fact, in my own work, I don't feel it's very useful to distinguish those two concepts, diaspora and transnationalism, in any sort of clear-cut way, because I often feel myself talking about diasporas, and I do think that the three countries have developed a very large number of people who are in the diaspora and who identify in a diasporic way, in different ways, of course. Exile, for example, is much more important for the Cubans than for the other two groups, Dominicans or Puerto Ricans. And so I've been constantly addressing this issue of borders and how borders and boundaries are crossed by migrants in multiple ways, not only physically, and I think that was also part of your earlier question, not only the act of moving and relocating from one place to another, but also crossing cultural boundaries, for example, racial ones, linguistic ones, even the idea, for example, that I'm actually studying right now with some colleagues, that Cubans, Puerto Ricans, and Dominicans, and I'll stay with those three groups because they're the ones that I know best, are somehow merging into this pan-Latino, Hispanic identity. And in fact, what we're finding in a comparative study that we're conducting right now with those three groups in Miami, in Orlando, New York, is that they don't. They don't really cross frequently those boundaries. They continue to cling to their national identities, and then they are more tied to the home countries than to other Latino groups in all these places.
Yeah, I feel like that is, there's a disjuncture between how these groups are thinking of themselves and how they are being perceived by, you know, white Anglo US based people who don't have any Latin or Hispanic affiliation or too much understanding either. And I think that that's an interesting phenomenon, that's a issue with how we are, you know, like white non-Hispanic non-Latin people are taught to view these groups. It's just not accurate, and those groups are so much more multifaceted and complex than we are taught, and it's like, oh, they're Hispanic.
And even to add to the complexity, of course, the growing use of Latinx or even Latine in some quarters is even more daunting, because again, most of the evidence that I have seen suggests that those terms are not used by the people that they're supposed to describe.
Right. And there's a subset of people who are, and then a lot of people aren't, especially if they're older generations or people who came directly from Spanish-speaking countries where those terms don't make sense in Spanish, for example. And it's complex. I'm a historian, so I'm always very interested in where we came from. And I really liked that the book started with the history of all of this, right? Like, how did we end up here? How did we end up with the conceptualizations and identities that we are currently trying to contest and understand? So if you could briefly talk about the beginning of the book and how this study is framed and how you are situating these conversations, some of which in the essays that are in this book are historical, where you're kind of starting with that. I study Cuba in the decades before you really start. You really start with the US invasion in 1898 is where you really pick up with the history in this book specifically. I'm a few decades ahead of that. But I'm interested in kind of how the very intertwined histories of Cuba, Puerto Rico, and the United States are contributing to these phenomena that are happening in this essay and what your understanding of those intertwined and maybe diverging histories have to do with each other.
Yeah, that's a great question. Let me see if I can address it in several parts. First, I want to mention that the original title of the edited volume was Two Wings of One Bird, which makes reference to a very famous poem by Lola Rodriguez de Tio, the Puerto Rican poet who spent much of her life in exile in Cuba. And in fact, many Cubans think that it wasn't Lola, but José Martí, who famously said that. But anyway, there's a poem called A Cuba, which has those famous lines, Cuba and Puerto Rico are like two wings of the same bird, and together they receive flowers and bullets in the same heart. And somehow that expression, I think, helps to answer your question and also to connect the various chapters. There are, I think, 16 chapters, if I'm not mistaken. 16, yes, including my own. Even though they do deal with different topics, history, literature, culture, music in particular, migration, etc., they somehow, the running theme is this question of how exactly do the histories, cultures, and traditions of each of these countries intertwine? When do they separate? And why it makes sense to approach them in a systematic, comparative fashion? So I would just begin maybe by saying that I think during the 16th, from the 16th to the 19th century, so once the two countries were colonized by Spain in the late 15th century, but really fully beginning in the 1500s, and then all the way up to 1898, basically share the same colonial background, even though, of course, Cuba was much larger and much more important in terms of the trade between the Americas and Spain. Havana was one of the largest colonial cities in the Americas. And Puerto Rico was always sort of marginal to the Spanish empire, except that after the independence of the various mainland colonies of Spanish America, the last remaining colonies were Spain or Cuba and Puerto Rico, and that then gave more importance to Cuba, which was again sort of the jewel of the crown, but also to Puerto Rico, which began to develop its own sugar and coffee agricultural economy, and Puerto Rico actually became the second largest sugar producer after Cuba during the 19th century. Same language, similar dialect. The Catholic religion was imposed on both islands and remained the only official religion for centuries. The food, the music, etc. Anyone who visits both countries can appreciate many of the parallels between the two countries, especially those having to do with cultural and linguistic, as well as geographic connections. Of course, you know, maybe that's sort of the beginning of the story has to do with the fact that both countries are islands or archipelagos. They're located in the larger Antilles, and the tropical climate is similar, and the landscape, etc. So those are the similarities. Now, the differences, of course, can be traced back to the Spanish colonial period. As I already mentioned, I think Cuba, and particularly Havana, became critical to the Spanish Empire during the 19th century. It was really the wealthiest and most important, the most faithful colony during the 19th century. That was the term that the Spanish used. Of course, they weren't so faithful after 1868 when a 30-year war for independence began in Cuba. But the main differences, I think, really arise in the 20th century, and we trace some of those, and each one of the chapters picks up on particular aspects of these political and economic trends that characterize the 20th century, which, of course, begin with the end of the Spanish-American War or the Spanish-Cuban-American War, if you want to be politically correct, when Cuba became independent in 1902, whereas Puerto Rico remained officially an unincorporated territory of the United States until it became then a Commonwealth in 1952. And clearly, the two countries diverged politically and economically in a major way after 1959 with the triumph of the Cuban Revolution. And of course, I'm summarizing with a very complex historical process, but in the last six decades or so, Cuba became a model of a certain type of socialist, one-party, centrally planned economy, whereas Puerto Rico became more integrated into the U.S. orbit, and for a while at least became a model of economic and political development under capitalism and U.S. Supervision, so to speak, what was then called in the early part of the 20th century, I forget the exact term, but anyway, it was a country that's not independent, that is not sovereign, but it's not part of the United States either, as one of the 50 states. And one or two, actually, of the chapters, one by Francisco Scarano, another one by Lilian Guerra, actually dispute the idea, the sort of generally received idea that the two countries are now completely separate, completely different, and that they have nothing in common. And I think that's a very insightful observation, that besides the differences, the very clear differences in the government organization of the two countries, the economic system, that there are some continuing issues. For example, the fact that neither of the two countries has been able to develop its own model of economy that they have relied first in the case of Puerto Rico on the U.S. for all this time, and then in the case of Cuba first on the Soviet Union, and more recently on Venezuela, and that the living standards of both countries are quite fragile precisely because they haven't been able to address those basic sort of subsistence issues. So that in a nutshell, I know it's a lot to say in just a few minutes, but I think it's our logic and our justification for putting this book together and trying to dialogue between the two countries in a single volume.
Yeah, that's a great summary, I think, actually. And it makes a lot of sense that we are going to approach these countries and at various points, colonies, territories, unincorporated, annexed territory, you know, whatever they were at various points in history, together, but also kind of diverging in interesting ways. And I wanted to talk, I know that this wasn't an essay that you wrote, it's right before your essay near the end of the volume, but briefly talking about the experiences of just to, again, talk about the issue of the monolith, the assumption that all migrants from the Latin American and Caribbean region are monoliths. I kind of got that narrative, I think, in school and just socially, generally, until I really started seeking this out and trying to learn specific information about specific groups. But the experiences of the Orientales and the Habaneros or Habaneras that came to Cuba and their experiences just briefly in the United States and how those different migrant groups kind of represent the complicated nature of migration.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most original contributions of the book. It's written by Blanca Ortiz and I always somehow forget the name of Mario Cancel, the co-author. It's about the migration, the recent migration of Cubans to Puerto Rico. So in many ways, it sort of extends my own work that I mentioned earlier. But then it focuses on the regional differences, as you mentioned. And those of our listeners who are familiar with Cuban history and Cuban culture will know that there are historically and even today great differences between the so-called Orientales, people from Oriente, the eastern provinces of Cuba, and Habaneros, particularly the western provinces of the island. In my own family, my father's family is from Santiago, so he's an Oriental, and my mother's family is from Havana, so I have personally experienced those issues as well. But what Ortiz and Cancel focus on is precisely the sense of displacement that many Orientales felt, even within their own country. So that when they migrated to from Santiago, say, or from Holguín to Havana, they often were shunned and discriminated against because of their accent. Supposedly, you know, in Havana, these Orientales don't know how to speak Spanish correctly, and Habaneros are proud of speaking a better Spanish. Although, of course, then Habaneros have face the same kind of prejudice when they leave the island. Not in Miami, where the Havana accent prevails. But and then, of course, the racial undertones of those complicated relationships between different parts of the country. You may know, and others may also know, that in Cuba, the term that's used to describe internal migrants from Orientes, Palestinos or Palestinians, you know, as if they were refugees from another country. And of course, maybe the implication that they're coming from the East, but it's a very negative, pejorative image of these Orientales. What Ortiz Torres and Rodriguez Cancel found is that Orientales who moved to Puerto Rico actually are very comfortable. They tend to mingle into Puerto Rican culture. Their accent doesn't stand out as much as it does perhaps in Havana, because there are historical and linguistic links between Puerto Rico and the eastern provinces of Cuba that they feel at home in many cases. And that compared to the U.S. especially, they don't find, of course, there are no language differences like they are perhaps in other parts of the U.S. But in Puerto Rico, this particular group of people, the latest wave, seems to integrate quite well, and it will probably be absorbed by Puerto Rican society pretty soon without any major conflicts. I'd like to add that, you know, in the 1980s, when I was doing my dissertation, I found that Cubans of different origins, not just from Oriente, but in general from the island, were intermarrying Puerto Ricans by a large margin. This is 1983. So by now, I don't have the quantitative data to document it, but I think it's pretty clear that Puerto Ricans and Cubans have married with each other, that their children, who are products of mixed Puerto Rican and Cuban marriages, identify with the Puerto Rican culture and therefore become fully integrated into Puerto Rican society.
Yeah, thanks for that explanation. And it's interesting, too, that you have some personal connection to it. And I think that also just looking at like specific either expat or exile communities in places like Miami is really interesting. And especially because you're in Florida. And so you're there, you're probably able, if you're in anthropology, you're probably doing some direct work with people. I guess now my question is, what does that look like right now in Florida doing this type of work? What are you working on right now? And where do you see your scholarship going?
Yeah, I mentioned briefly that I'm part of a comparative study, collaborative research project with colleagues in at the University of Central Florida in Orlando and the City University of New York, which focus on Puerto Ricans in the case of Orlando and Dominicans in the case of New York. So we don't have yet results to share, but as I mentioned earlier, what we are finding is that most of the interviews that we have conducted suggest that people cling very much to their national identities rather than embrace a pan-ethnic identity. We'll have to figure out exactly why that is happening and then, you know, unpack it by generation, by age, perhaps race, all kinds of different variables. So that's my current research project. Now, in terms of the Cuban community here in Miami, unfortunately, I have to say that there hasn't been any study that I know of that focuses on these regional differences here. We do know that most of the Cuban-American community are people who come from Havana, and that is a well-established fact. But we don't know, for example, how this group of Habaneros relates to other groups from the rest of the island, except on an anecdotal basis in which, for example, I can tell you from my own experience that when people, when Cubans here in Miami listen to your accent in Spanish, you know, they don't recognize exactly where it's from, they might tell you, oh, you sound like an Oriental. You know, you sound like somebody from Oriente, which again, because of that long history, which goes back to the early colonial period, you know, the rivalry between Santiago and Havana, basically means that you're not Cuban or you don't sound Cuban enough, you know. And it's, these are very minor differences between the Spanish that's spoken in different regions of Cuba and by extension the Caribbean. Just to give you a couple of examples, the word plátano or guineo to refer to bananas, right, is different in Havana and Santiago. And in Santiago, the preferred term is guineo, but to an habanero ear, that doesn't ring a bell. I mean, they know what it is, but it's not the word that they use. And there are other examples of that. There are very minor differences in vocabulary and intonation, et cetera. But I think at a more general level, and it speaks to something that you also mentioned earlier, it helps to understand the diversity of the Cuban-American population, that even though they all call themselves Cuban, they have different backgrounds, different generations as well, different racial statuses, and of course, class, which is clearly a source of fragmentation of the Cuban-American community.
Definitely, and we can see why and how certain parts of the Cuban population are being mobilized in Florida specifically for certain political purposes because of some of those class and other differences. And I want to talk briefly too about the final essay in the volume, which is your own essay about your personal experience. Obviously, you talked about this more at the beginning, but I wanted to talk a bit about how you've kind of, as a scholar, handled, you know, this very kind of academic approach, especially with anthropology, where you're trying to, you know, isolate factors and do all of these kind of more academic moves, but then also you're very personal and probably very emotional and, you know, close to you investment in this type of work. And how, I mean, I don't personally see that as in conflict, or it shouldn't be in conflict, but I think probably it has been at points, and how you've kind of contended with that.
Yeah. And again, I'm sorry that my co-editor, Carmen Aide Rivera, can't join us today, but because I know that she has a lot to say precisely about this issue from her own personal point of view as the child of a returned migrant family from Puerto Rico that left decades ago and who retained their Puerto Rican identity in Boston. And then when she went back to complete her PhD in Puerto Rico, and now she teaches English rather than Spanish, that makes for a very interesting combination. I think the actual pairing up of our own histories and academic identities, the fact that she's in literature and in the humanities, whereas I'm coming from the social sciences. But I think what I can say about that is that we're all part of the study of the object of study that we are focusing on in this book. And that extends to some of the, in fact, many of the contributors who are either Cuban or Puerto Rican or another ethnicity. There's a Panamanian, for example, in the collection as well. So each one of us approaches the topic from a very personal point of view. However, I'm the only one in this collection that does that explicitly, you know, and I have to say this is not the typical essay that I write. I tend to write in the third person, you know, and kind of hide myself from view. But I did try to reflect upon my own positionality and how that position as a Cuba Rican places me both inside and outside the topics that I'm interested in. And we've mentioned some of them, the question of identity, how identities shift from one place to another, the question of language, English and Spanish, and the combination of Puerto Rican and Cuban culture that I also in my own life experience. So at the same time, I think we all agree, I think, in this book that we have to attempt to use the analytical tools of our disciplines, whether it's history, anthropology, or literature, or music, musicology, to understand better our own personal experiences in the context of a wider field of study. So this is not a book about ourselves, but it's really a book about, you know, the histories, cultures, and societies of the two countries as they intersect with each other. And I finally, maybe I want to add that both Carmen Aide and myself, and I'm sure many of the others who contributed to the book, are clearly committed to advancing the knowledge and understanding of the Cuban and Puerto Rican diasporas to which we belong. And this is a continuing struggle, I would say, because, for instance, there's still a divide between Puerto Ricans living on the island and Puerto Ricans living in the United States. It has to do with language. It has to do with, again, migration experiences, generation, etc. And so I think we both see our work, Carmen Aide and myself, as expanding the boundaries of traditional discourses of the nation. And in my case, for the Cuban nation also, I have argued elsewhere that I don't think it's useful any longer to define the meaning of being Cuban by restricting it to the territory of the homeland, but rather a very complex and, as they used to say in the old days, dialectic relationship with the territory and the place of origin and the place where people are living now.
Yeah, and there's so many Cubans who are outside of Cuba and then retain that identity, and that's really important. I haven't really looked at those exile communities, but a lot of scholars do, and I think it's something I will have to do at some point. And I want to say, yes, the idea of positionality, I'm very interested in positionality as a white scholar who studies whiteness and blackness and how they're kind of mutually constituting each other and how they are, they don't exist without each other, in other words. And I think that that is really important to do as a scholar. And I'm really glad that that is, we're moving towards this very rich, you know, a lot of times first person narrative to talk about, because as a historian, we do not use first person either, to really put ourselves back into that work and dialogue in that way. I think it's it creates this richer, kind of more human experience where, you know, we are not separate from our work. We are ourselves when we are doing research. We are not stepping outside of our bodies. And so I think that that essay was a great way to end the volume. And I just want to say thanks for doing that work. And I also wanted to say too that, you know, Jorge and Carmen Aide Rivera, who is the other editor of this volume, they did an interview in Spanish for New Books Network Español. So if you understand Spanish and you're interested in receiving more information and getting, you know, her perspective as well, check out that interview. They go into depth about who they are and what they're doing as scholars and also with this volume specifically. All right. Well, thanks so much for coming on today, Jorge. And we look forward to hearing more about that work you're doing and reading more books in the future.
Thank you, Anna. And thank you for having me in this conversation.
Certainly.